The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 19th of March, 2020. On the podcast today, I have Majid Shafiq, CEO of i3 Energy. i3E is ticker there. Majid discusses the drilling contract they've agreed with Dolphin Drilling and also provides an operational timeline. Also on the podcast, Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com, discusses whether the coronavirus pandemic is a short, sharp shock to the economy or a long-lasting one. And Chris also covers news from companies Next, Burberry, AutoTrader and National Express. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs. You can see both these lists, in fact, top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Majid Shafiq, CEO of i3 Energy. i3E is ticker there. Majid, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Justin. Good to speak to you again.
Yeah, well, you've had some news out today about operations there and drilling and the contract, and we'll dig into that in a bit. Before we do, as always, Majid, if someone's listening right now has never heard of i3 Energy or vaguely heard of you, could you just explain the business, please?
Yeah, so i3 Energy is an oil and gas company with operations in the North Sea. We're listed on the AIM market. We have a couple of licenses in the North Sea, which contain two discoveries, the Liberator discovery and the Serenity discovery, which we drilled last, both of which properties we drilled last year, and the Serenity discovery was made in last year's drilling program. We have, we believe, several hundred million barrels of STOIIP in those assets, and we are looking to continue with an appraisal program and move them towards development.
Okay, so the news today and your agreement with Dolphin Drilling, what does that mean for the company, Majid?
Right, so firstly, we've secured a rig for the summer with a drilling company that we like working with, Dolphin Drilling, who did a really good job for us last year. So they've got two rigs that they can operate in the North Sea, and both of them are potential rigs that we can use this summer. So that's really important. So we know that we will be drilling within a few months, subject to financing, of course, but we know that we'll be drilling and we'll be providing some very high-impact catalysts to our shareholders. As I said, Dolphin are an excellent drilling company, and so and performed really well for us last year. So we're confident that those wells will be drilled on budget and on time. Thirdly, we've farmed out a 10% economic interest in the license to Dolphin. So that, in our mind, is excellent news. Dolphin are an industry player. They operate in the oil and gas business, obviously. They understand the nature of these assets, and they've decided to participate in the license. Quite unusual for a drilling company to do that. So we think, you know, that's a really good industry validation. We've also secured what we think are very good terms for that farm-in. So they, you know, Dolphin are going to be paying circa 22% of the costs of the wells in return for a 10% economic interest in the license, up to a commitment of $14.4 million in total. And that's if we drill the entire program, the optional program and the firm program. But that's $14.4 million for a 10% interest, which gives us an implied valuation of $144 million for the license, which is obviously way in excess of where our shares are trading at the moment. We're not expecting our share price to move to that level. But, you know, this is a trade on the license, and it's with an industry partner. So we think it's a very helpful data point in terms of evaluation. So yeah, that you know, those are the key points. So I think it's, you know, it's an excellent result, and it will also help with our farm out process, which is ongoing. And obviously, once we get the farm out done, with the commitment from Dolphin and the access to their rigs, it means that we can continue with our drilling program, improving up the value that we have in our licenses later on this summer.
Okay, excellent. So can you just go a bit further into the financing agreement between you and Dolphin? Give us a bit more detail, if you could, Majid.
Obviously, we can't. I can't give a great amount of detail because it's the details are confidential. But you know, we have obviously released in an RNS the high level information on the deal. But essentially, at our option, we can ask Dolphin to forego their profit margin in the rig contract, up to a total amount of 14.4 million. And to get to the 14.4 million, that would involve the drilling of the optional program, sorry, the firm program, which is the 82 days, and the optional program, which is another 78 days. And the optional program would have the two wells in it on Serenity, and sorry, the firm program would have the two wells on Serenity, and the optional program would have the two wells on Liberator West and the Minos High. So, it, as I say, it would be our option to ask them to forgo the profit margin. We could pay the rig rate if we chose to do so. And in return for foregoing the profit margin up to 14.4 million, they would then earn up to a 10% net revenue sharing interest. So this is in the license, in the 1323C license. This is an economic interest. It's not a working interest. So it'd be revenue after all costs, essentially, and all costs to development of Serenity. So including all development costs, CapEx, etc., operating costs. And then there's a couple of, there's effectively a call and a put option. So we have a right to buy back the net revenue sharing interest anytime before an FDP is approved. And in return for that, we'd have to pay 125% of whatever commitment Dolphin had made at that point. And Dolphin have a right to sell it back to us if we get an FDP approved for greater than 25 million barrels. And we would then have to, in that circumstance, have to pay them back their commitment plus an 8% accrued coupon. So you know, we think it's a really good deal for both parties. There's a lot of flexibility in there, and you know, it provides a significant contribution to the costs of our drilling program, 22% essentially, which means we've got less to farm out through our current farm out process.
Excellent stuff. Okay, so can you take us through what the planned drilling program will include, please, Majid?
Yeah, so the firm program will include two appraisal wells on Serenity and a sidetrack on each of those appraisal wells. The first appraisal well will be towards the centre of the field. Mm-hmm. And what we'll be looking to appraise there is the thickness of the reservoir, essentially. And the second appraisal well will move further to the west to confirm again the thickness of the reservoir, which we expect to thicken as we move towards the west. Remember, we found circa 10 foot in the discovery well, and there's a well off the structure to the west of our license block, which has over 130 feet. So we're expecting the sand to thicken towards the west. So the main appraisal risk that we're looking to determine is how thick the sand is. And as we're hoping to see it thickening to the west, and hopefully we'll see that with these two appraisal wells. The second appraisal well will also test the limits of the structure towards the west. And then the sidetracks will be dependent upon what we find in the vertical wells that we drill. They may be drilled up dip or down dip, but obviously contingent on what we're seeing on the wells and in the logs. Mm-hmm. The optional program will be to drill the upside that we have in Liberator. So Liberator was drilled last year, and it was the eastern part and the central part of it that we drilled. And the issue that we had with those wells was that the thickness of the reservoir and the mapping was more complicated, and the thickness of the reservoir that we found was thinner than we'd hoped. But we know in the West, the seismic suggests that the reservoir thickness is much higher. There's much more relief above the oil-water contact, and it would be those thicker reservoirs sections that we would be looking to test with the appraisal wells in the optional program. So all of the wells that we drill will be very high impact. Serenity, we believe, has 200 million barrels in place on a mid-case analysis. And these two wells, if we drill them where we anticipate that we are going to drill them, will test all of that 200 million barrels. So the two Serenity wells, we're hoping on success, will confirm our model and tell us that we have 200 million barrels in place, and we think we've got, you know, recovery factors of at least 50%, so 100 million barrels recoverable on Serenity. Liberator West, and particularly the Minos High, has several hundred million barrels in place, and the Minos High could be bigger than Serenity. So if we do drill those wells, then there will be equally as high impact as the Serenity wells that we're drilling.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Okay, and what can you tell us about the farm-out discussions, and will they benefit your agreement with Dolphin?
Yeah, they will. The Dolphin agreement will should benefit our farm-out discussions. So we started the farm-out after the new year, and we really got people coming through the data room in February. The data room is still active. We've had a number of companies come through. Some companies of very significant size. We've had very good meetings. The data evaluation is still ongoing, and we're having good discussions with a number of counterparties. And, you know, we're hoping that at least one of them will come through, and we'll end up with a farm-out agreement to assist us with the funding requirement on top of the funding commitment that we've got from Dolphin. So we're, you know, reasonably confident that we, despite, you know, the current market circumstances is causing a lot of companies to ponder their CapEx programs. But that doesn't mean that there's not going to be any CapEx at all in the North Sea. There will be, and there will be drilling. And certainly the companies that we're speaking to have large balance sheets that can withstand the near-term storm. And we're still in, you know, productive discussions with counterparties, and very hopeful that we will get a farm-out concluded.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you did mention there's a section there about the coronavirus and COVID in the announcement there, and obviously the weak oil prices. And, you know, how do you see that impacting, you know, mid to long term here?
Well, in terms of COVID-19 impact on Serenity right now, there is no impact. We're following government and health body guidelines. Majority of people are working from home. That's perfectly feasible to do. We can run our geological reservoir simulation models that run on the machines in the office from laptops at home. So we're not impacted at the moment by COVID in any significant way, and it's because we're not operating. Obviously, once we start drilling in the late summer, we'll have to see how this pandemic has progressed and whether it's under control, and what the impacts are on the industry in a wider sense. Clearly, there will be potentially some impacts in operations offshore. If the pandemic is widespread and impacts offshore workers and impacts transportation, etc., which it will do to some extent. As I say, we're isolated from that at the moment because our drilling operations are several months away. We're obviously in contact with Dolphin. They have not yet been impacted. They're actually drilling at the moment for Shell. So we hopefully things will be in a better situation in a few months, and we will be able to start our drilling operations and not be impacted. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In terms of Serenity, we've run our economics on Serenity. We've run lots of different scenarios and looked at different development options, from standalone options to options being tied back to nearby infrastructure. And the project, you know, if the volumes are there as we expect them to be, the project is very, very economic and returns NPVs of several hundred million dollars to well in excess of $1 billion, depending on what oil price you use. We've obviously tested the those development scenarios to different oil prices, and we have a break-even development price for Serenity of $20 a barrel. Brent may well test $20 a barrel in the near term, but you know, we don't expect that to be the case in the medium term. We fully expect the oil price to recover once these macroeconomic issues work themselves out. And obviously, we're not producing from Serenity at the moment. It is a development. The actual production, first oil, will be sometime beyond today's date, and we're hopeful that the oil price will have recovered. We won't be looking at $20 a barrel. We'll be looking at higher price. In that case, it's a very, very profitable development because it's a relatively low cost development with potentially very high production rates from the wells.
Mm-hmm. All the stuff. Okay, well, Majid, three final things to do. If someone's listening right now, likes the sound of the progress you're making there, but are not yet following the story, just give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay, well, firstly, we, like most of our peers, are trading at very, very low share prices at the moment. We believe this is a buying opportunity, not just for us, but for many of our peers in the oil and gas sector. But we've just had, you know, industry validation of our geological model for the assets on our license, particularly the Serenity field, and we've had somebody farm in to that license, you know, in the current environment, which is very difficult. So that's very positive, and we've had a valuation placed on our licenses of $144 million by that deal. You know, secondly, we've secured a rig with a very good drilling company that performed really well for us last year. And so we will have a rig to drill our wells in the late summer on Serenity and possibly on the Minos High and Liberator West. And so there are some potentially some really big near-term catalysts, particularly in our firm program on Serenity, which will, you know, we believe confirm that we've got a very large resource base. So there's a significant near-term catalyst to move the share price within the next few months. And Serenity itself is a very, very, will be a very profitable development if we confirm, you know, that we've got at least our mid case of a couple of hundred million barrels in place. It's a low cost development and has very high rates of return because it's low cost and because of the nature of the reservoir, which will deliver very, very productive wells.
Excellent stuff, Majid. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Yeah, very good, thanks. I mean, obviously, you know, deeply volatile, in quotes, excitable and strange conditions, but surviving and as always, looking forward.
Okay, let me ask you the big question, right? Straight out of the gate here, big one. Let's see where you respond to this. Do you think this is like a 3 to 6 month shock, or is it longer lasting?
I think it's a shorter term shock. So the first of the two options. I say that with fingers crossed and everything else, but here's how I see it. We've clearly seen that China and other parts of Northeast Asia have had some success in getting past the intense stage of the coronavirus. They've obviously done stuff which has inhibited movement and everything else, and clearly we're copying elements of that. But they're continuing to test people, which is possibly something we need to do more of as well. Seems to be that's going to be the case. Mm-hmm. So far, those areas haven't seen reinfection. You know, currently China today, for example, it had zero organic cases, i.e. internally generated cases.
Yeah.
The only people that were newly coronavirus positive in China were those who had come from other countries, including the UK. So, you know, that gives me a little bit of hope. If you can get to sort of something like that point, you know, the Chinese, obviously their big crackdown started in the latter part of January. And obviously here we are now, let's call it 2 months afterwards. And, you know, we are where we are with China and other parts of Northeast Asia. So, you know, you roll that forward and that would obviously fit within that sort of 3 to 6 month timescale and related. What you do need to see, though, is, as I say, no reinfection and that testing that allows us to gain confidence and hence go back to work and all the other stuff that a normal economy does. So it's clearly a difficult, unprecedented, strange time. But at the moment, I'm keeping optimistic and I'm keeping thought that that's going to be the scenario. And so the impact on companies is you get through the unbelievably difficult March, April period. In May, maybe things get a little bit easier and that progressively becomes more the case as we move into the summer. Which obviously, from a stock market investor's point of view, is you ask the right question, because the thing is, do you sort of price this as a 1 to 2 quarter horror show in terms of you know, the very commercial issues of earnings and profits and cash flow and whatever, or do you say, well, actually, this is something which is going to impact not just 2020, but 2021 and the foreseeable future, which clearly is a different scenario. And market, for what it's worth, I think markets today have priced that not just the March, April significant slowdown, but I think the May kind of extremely unbelievably patchy trading as well, very, very patchy trading. I think if it then moves into the summer in terms of that level of crackdown, of uncertainty, of lack of normality, if you like, then markets are going to have to take a look at it again, because I don't think that is priced in my opinion. But I'm taking some, drawing some hope from the Chinese experience, and even in some of those very distressing images from places like Italy. Some of the data there in terms of new cases, again, small cause for optimism. So, as always, we will see. But I think what it tells you about stock markets and related is, number one, it's always wise to sort of have a plan, but never to put all your eggs in one basket. So diversification is always a winner here. Avoiding leverage, we all know that, and debt and stretched balance sheets are typically things which cause issues for companies, and we've certainly seen that. So I think for the fundamental stock picking investor, all of those, if you like, old and traditional rules have kind of played out. We've clearly got a very strange circumstance. I mean, there's no getting away from that. But I think for the forward-looking medium-term investor, you know, there are things to be doing and things to be thinking about and sort of plans and strategies to be had. But yeah, I think the key
it's a phenomenal shock, isn't it? Because like I said, the stock market, I mean, the reason why it's called a correction is because we're assuming future earnings are not going to be what they're expected to be. And so the stock market is correcting to adjust that value adjustment. And it's doing that now. And the reason why it's so volatile is it doesn't know at the moment. It's going dropping down because everything is, like yesterday, I don't know if you saw the big Ford, GM, all those big companies in America are shutting down. Everything's shutting down. So you're going from, you know, business as normal, which it was slowing anyway, but actually stopping. And we don't know how long it's stopping for. There's that open-ended, isn't it, time frame where the market doesn't know how to price that in. And that's why it's just all over the place. But if you look at some of the fallers, I did tweet out today saying, here's the top 20 biggest falling FTSE 100 companies over the last 4 weeks. Which do you think will be the first to double and why? And you've got Carnival, you know, 78% down. EasyJet, 66% down. TUI, 66%. JD Sports, 65%. And I think, you know, looking at all those, and you've got even, you know, Whitbread down 55%, ITV 54%, Barclays down 54%. And there's some good names there, isn't it? Cracking names.
Yeah.
The Prudential, you know, all in the 50s, 60s, 70%. And it's like, you know, I can't believe that, you know, they're going to stay that way for long. I do think we'll have maybe, I don't know if it's, maybe it'll be, it will be a sort of, you know, U-shaped or whatever, but I mean, is a good business. And I think the things to look at now, especially over the next 3 months maybe, are companies that have these kind of direct debit recurring revenues that don't get affected by this. And I mean, and typically they haven't fallen that much. I mean, you know, we're talking about sort of, like I said, the BTs maybe, Sky and all that kind of, those kind of companies that get, you know, recurring revenue via direct debit, and they don't have to be physically delivered to you, you know, delivered via, you know, the internet, you know. So, I mean, that's a look at. But, yeah. But, yeah, some bargains. Yeah, bargains to be had there, isn't it?
There are. Assuming that that broader macro virus related stuff works out, i.e., there is an end, we move out, and you know, I think ultimately a vaccine will be developed. But clearly, that is probably something for a longer time period. I think shorter term is about suppression and non-reinfection, which obviously things like the summer can also help with. You would have thought, all other things being equal, so. For me, when I look at many of those names you just mentioned, I think to myself, okay, the filter is, what's the balance sheet like? How sustainable and resilient can the business be? Are there assets in play there which, when things do move back to something a bit more like normality, which people pick up, see are useful and related? And, you know, that is a good debate. You know, this undoubtedly, in terms of, there will be some, no doubt, fortunes made in extremely sketchy companies that you think are on the cusp of bankruptcy and miraculously come out and survive. But in terms of the quality longer term money, it's all about good balance sheets, sensible businesses doing good things. So, you know, just to take one of those names as an example, when I look at something like Whitbread, you know, Premier Inn, we clearly, you don't need to be a genius to work out that a lack of travel inhibits their business ultra materially. And that's absolutely true. But if you look at them, they own many of their sites. They've got low debt, thanks to Costa obviously being purchased by Coca-Cola a year and change ago. So, you know, even though it's going to impact them horribly, clearly the earnings base is going to be impacted very materially and related, they're a survivor. And as a survivor, when they come out the other end, they're going to be, you would have thought, in a much better position than a bunch of other names in that space which have sketchier ownership and leveraged balance sheets and whatever else. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's thinking about those sorts of things. But in terms of committing capital, I think you invest according to your plan. And certainly the majority of the monies that I invest are my pension fund. And, you know, I have obviously... I've got, fortunately or unfortunately, a good few years until retirement, so I can afford to take a medium-term view, and that to me is interesting and a good challenge, shall we say, out of all of this horror and uncertainty, for the next, not just the next 6 months, but for the next few years. So yeah, keep your head. Don't borrow money in order to invest because you think it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You might be right, but my feeling is there's enough leverage in the markets already. And if you're a sensible medium-term investor, think about profile, brand, resilience, and everything else. And those businesses will be the ones that will come back with the least amount of heartburn and whatever else that goes with day-to-day market volatility.
Yeah. You know, even I mean, I've got cash in the portfolio there, but even I was thinking, should I remortgage the house here? It was a fleeting thought. Because I just think,
the answer always is no. Because, what's the first thing you do, I mean, yeah, there's some genius out there who will do that and will make a fortune, but for 99% of people, it's not the smart thing to do. Because what happens is, you know, when you have leverage and big debts, I'm sure many people, sadly, are maybe in this position or elements of it, it inhibits your thinking. Either it forces you to have a casino-like approach to the market, or it makes you very risk-averse and you can't make those, you know, potentially useful but difficult decisions. So do all the important stuff first, roof over the head, you know, whatever else, and food on the table and all of that sort of thing. Then ideally, actually, in a pension fund setup or a SIP or something where it is medium-term focused, ISA or whatever, you know, make your choices and invest accordingly over a time frame that's right for you, depending on where you are with your life cycle and everything else. So that's how I do it and feel about it. And actually, that makes me much more comfortable. I can take a bit more risk in my SIP because maybe the monies are there to be invested for the longer term pension. let's think about things from that perspective. And that certainly helped me back in the global financial crisis. We're now in another crisis, the coronavirus crisis. Let's adopt a similar approach, I think, albeit circumstances are, you know, a bit different from the global financial crisis. It's every crisis is always a bit different.
Yeah, marvellous. Any companies daring to put out news about? We are living in an exceptional time because, you know, there was a time not too long back when companies were actually putting out RNSs with Brexit in the title, and now it's COVID-19, isn't it? So are there any companies daring to release news at the moment?
Well, there is a bunch of companies. I mean, the COVID-19 ones are all pretty much saying the same thing, impact, and talking about their banking arrangements and whatever else. But Next is probably worth a quick talk, because Next actually had their full year statement. It was a proper pucker update, although inevitably they talked about the coronavirus materially. So the numbers themselves were all right. You know, Next is a solid middle of the road sort of business. So we'll ignore the numbers. They've made a little bit of progress. And obviously this is the year to the end of January, pre-coronavirus impact. Yeah. What they said about the coronavirus was absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Because what they did, and I have to say, read the Next regulatory news statement this morning that came out this morning.
Yeah.
It is an absolutely fascinating document, because they really went to town in terms of stress test and talking about how it impacted their business. Very impressive. And if you read that as a shareholder, you would say, this management team knows their business. They can't predict everything, because nobody can. But my goodness, they are thinking it through. They're the sort of team you want to back. And that was my gut feel in any case. Mm. What they said was basically sales could fall under certain circumstances up to 25% on a full year basis, which would be £1 billion+ of sales, which is pretty striking.
Which is basically losing a quarter, isn't it, essentially?
Yeah. That's right. And they said, look, we are set up. We have resilience. You know, if we need to suspend the dividend, we can do that. They're fortunate. They're in a very strong balance sheet position, obviously a well-run company. But they also said some other interesting stuff. They said, in terms of the difference between online and physical stores, they think tentatively that, unsurprisingly, online does better. That's kind of very obvious. But obviously, as the restrictions on movement and everything else continue, that gap gets bigger. However, online is not wholly offsetting, because as they put it, for clothes, if people aren't kind of going to work or going out or whatever else it might be, their desire to buy clothes goes down as well. Mm-hmm. So there were some interesting insights there. But essentially, I thought the approach they took of stress testing and talking about scenarios and talking about how they were going to deal with them, what was very impressive. That's why the shares were up when I last looked, you know, somewhere between 5% and 9%, and they're just shy of £40. But you have to say, in terms of it being a survivor of the retail space, when I look outside food retail, which obviously has certain defensive attributes, as we saw in the Morrison's numbers earlier this week, if you look at kind of non-food retail, number one biggish UK company that you would stick on your list would undoubtedly be Next. Mm-hmm. And even though, you know, you're not going to make an absolute fortune on it, I mean, I think if the shares doubled from here, they'd go to an all-time high or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's just not going to happen. In terms of the quality of the numbers, the resilience of that business, the reasonableness of the management and their common sense, you know, triple ticks in the box there. So very impressive statement. Have a read of it. That's how, in an ideal world, all companies would be communicating with their shareholders. It isn't going to happen, but I have to say, when you see it, you think to yourself, these guys have thought it through, and even though they're going to have to adjust their plan because nobody can predict the future perfectly, I've got faith in them. And that's what you've got to have with investments. When you see that, grab hold of it, because generally it pays off for you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, and do you know what? Looking at that list of the biggest fallers, like I said, Carnival at the top. Now, you may think, oh, that's the one to go for. But no, actually, you're probably better off going further down the list, someone that hasn't been as impacted. And you think, hang on, that'll turn around. For example, JD Sports. I mean, they've 10-bagged over the last 5 years because they've done very well, you know? And so they've had such a drop-off in like 65%. Think, well, hang on, have they been impacted that much? Of course, they may be a bit highly rated, but surely they're doing quite well because the management may be quite decent and, you know, it's just a good setup. So you're worth not going for the biggest, riskiest ones, but the ones that will gradually claw their way back nicely and smoothly, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And My knowledge of JD Sports is a little bit less, but I think they've certainly exhibited great retail skill. Certainly they've won the market share game with Mike Ashley at Sports Direct, or whatever Sports Direct now call themselves, Flannels or whatever it is. But absolutely. Another one just out today with a bit more of a COVID-19 update, but interesting nevertheless, was Burberry. Now, obviously, that's a different end completely from Next and JD Sports and whatever else, in much more in, obviously, in luxury and related. They talked about some quite big hits to their physical store network. You got to recall that they do a lot of their business in Asia, so obviously they've actually seen the coronavirus impact in their Greater China stores, China, Hong Kong, etc. So they've been talking about, in some cases, you know, big, you know, they quoted some big numbers, 50-70% down in some stores. They think, I believe, their quarter is going to be sort of 30-odd% down. So that's big, and that obviously continues because now it rolls into the UK and America and everything else, but maybe out of Asia. But they made some interesting points. What they said was, again, resilience of the company. They do have a touch of debt, but it's very low. And obviously what they have is brand. They do clearly an online presence, but for them, I think also they're a survivor, modest debt, strong brand, and obviously that Asian focus is about 40% of their sales. And I have to say, prospectively, that to me is an attractive attribute. So Burberry shares were either side of zero when I last looked. You know, they were little changed today, and they've obviously come down materially over recent months. But again, I read that statement, I thought to myself, this feels like a management team that have a plan and have time and have resilience as well. So I was impressed by that too. And certainly, I think in terms of if you were looking in something in that broader retail, clothing, even luxury area, Next and Burberry would be two sort of kind of core-ish sort of positions you could think about, maybe put something else around the edge if you wished or desired.
Yeah, wow. Then 23rd of Jan, they were £22. Now £10.61.
Yeah, pretty much. That's right. That's right. No, it is. And I did own Burberry shares before. I actually sold them last year. And I have to say, looking at today's improved price, I'm excited. I'm thinking to myself, this is the sort of level where to build a medium-term position in Burberry feels interesting. I doubt if I'll ever buy anything in their stores, but that doesn't matter, being an investor's at a different level. And brand, lowish, very low debt, Asia focus, that's not a bad combination.
Yeah, I think you probably should also just, you know, get into it. Full head-to-toe Burberry, Chris. Just I'm a shareholder.
No,
turn up as their shareholder meetings dressed head-to-toe in Burberry kit.
If the shares double, then maybe I can afford it, but there you go.
Imagine that. It'd be quite funny. Just completely, you know, devoted fan of Burberry, from shares to clothes, everything. Just hat, shoes.
I'm sure as and when AGMs and related are allowed again in person, I'm sure there are people who've rocked up to the Burberry AGM sort of dressed like that. Possibly the management, but anyway.
Imagine that. What's next? Anything else?
A couple of quickies, just for a bit of colour and insight, really. National Express shares, when I last looked, were bouncing there. Obviously, bus, coach, rail sort of operator. Quite interesting what they said. They noted that actually they obviously have a lot of interactions with government, local authorities and people like that because of the services they offer. They said there appears to have been an edict from government or something saying, keep paying these guys, because even though maybe people aren't currently using them as much, we've got to keep the transportation routes going. You know, NHS workers or whatever else it might be, some base system going, keep paying these guys so they keep on, you know, offering that. So that seemed to be happening in a majority of cases. That's why the shares bounce, because obviously in some other more commercial things, they're having to cut back and cut their costs and everything else. But I think that certainly has helped the sector today, which has been under a bit of pressure since, I think, Go Ahead had a bit of a gloomy update a week or so ago. So that's bounced those shares, and things like First Group, which have been very hit, a bit more indebted, also had a big bounce when I last looked earlier today.
That's even scarier, that chart. I mean, look at that. They were like, am I reading this right? And yeah, National Express, they were like £4 on 5th of March. That's right. Than 94 it's, pence.
Yeah, wow. That's right. And look at First Group, which went from a quid and change down to various points below 30p. I mean, the reason is because you've got that, if you think about what they do, it's transport. Yeah. If you think about the impact on it, it's obvious. And obviously, it's akin. Transport is obviously why you were quoting names such as Carnival or EasyJet or TUI. You know, they're wrapped up into that transportation infrastructure, leisure and whatever else at the same time. So, interesting times. And obviously, at the margin, when you hear about the schools closing, obviously, some of those companies have big school bus exposure. So, you know, the comment that what appears to be the local authorities are continuing paying because they've got to make sure. This is the thing. You've got to get the other side of this. And when you do, there's no point in having no system. I mean, that's madness. That's how you don't recover. It's kind of quite interesting stuff there. Final one, a bit more commercial. This is Auto Trader. To be honest, I've never owned Auto Trader stock. I don't think I ever probably will. But what they said today was quite interesting, I thought. They said that obviously Auto Trader, we all know what they do. You know, predominantly it's online now, rather than it used to be the grubby magazine that used to look for all the cars and everything else. But now it's all online. What they said was they were happy to defer people's advertisers' sort of charges for March and actually give them a freebie in April, which I thought was interesting and certainly shows to me that what they're trying to do is keep people thinking in a commercial way, even though they'll lose a bit of money having no advertising fees and whatever. Because as always, if you stop doing something, sometimes you just don't go back to do it. They know that people aren't going to be particularly motivated to buy cars for many obvious reasons, but they've got to try and keep some semblance of a service going in order, again, to help it on the way back, you know, when you get to the other side of all of this. So I thought that was striking because that kind of shows some of the thinking and innovation that maybe companies have to do. It's not just cutting costs and keeping your fingers crossed. It's actually being a bit proactive. So I applaud Auto Trader for that. It's an interesting strategy and quite eye-catching at a certain level, obviously with profit implications, but it's they're playing for a bigger game here. I personally, you know, that they have a little bit of debt and whatever else. So they talk about resilience and whatever in their update. But I thought that was quite striking, you know, as a strategy.
Yeah, I mean, it is. You know, I had this discussion online on Twitter yesterday about will people change their habits due to this quarantine and lockdown? And I said, you know, listen, I've been locked down for a week because my son has got a health condition. And, you know, we've had a cancel holiday. And already we're looking to rebook that holiday. And I think on the leisure side of it, I don't think we will change. But then I thought Carnival, you know, we've become accustomed to realising that those cruise ships are like a petri dish, you know, they breed germs. And I think, will people's lifestyles change? I think, you know, work-wise, I think there are a lot of companies now have already realised we can do this remotely and we don't have to pay for expensive offices. So maybe that'll change. But I don't think leisure will change as much, do you?
Yeah, I completely. You know, you and I have talked plenty of times about Into and other troubled property giants. You know, that's obviously more on the retail shopping side. Mm. But, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, you and I both have embraced working at home for large elements of the week. And it's initially a bit strange and sometimes has some interesting implications. But actually, you get used to it very quickly. And the flexibility and other aspects, I think, way outweigh. You know, now when I have to go into an office, obviously, won't be for a while. But when I do, when I have dropped in recent years, it feels staid and boring. And I think to myself, people look depressed in them. So, you know, we have, I think it is going to change. Alibaba said on their conference call, Alibaba, obviously the big Chinese e-commerce company, a month ago, obviously when China was in the midst of all of this, they said, this is actually going to accelerate digital utilization and embracing. And, you know, they said that within China, where if you go there, it's absolutely amazing the amount of mobile commerce and app-led stuff that people do. So, yeah, it's going to drive things in different ways. I completely agree. I think in terms of working, in terms of aspects like that, it isn't going to go back to how it was. And actually, that's probably a good thing. A bit of change is good at a big picture level, but I think that it's all we know that the information and internet economy, it is different, it is evolving, it is impacting. Yeah, so this is part of it. Leisure travel, you know, we'll have to see. I've got a feeling You're right at one level. I don't think people's instinct to, it's not going to stop them completely traveling, whatever, but it's going to take a while to get back. I mean, at one level, well, I think the restrictions on travel will be lifted sooner rather than later, clearly. But I think people have got to think about their own personal balance sheet. And obviously, if you do have impacts in terms of earnings and whatever else, that may flow through in terms of what people choose to do for their leisure. But we'll see. I mean, ultimately, you've got to live and learn, and you've got to keep on thinking and moving forward. So I think the trick is to get the other side of the worst aspect of these cases, and then we can start all moving on.
Mm-hmm. Marvellous stuff, Chris. Thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak to you next week.
Sounds the plan. See you then.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. And this list normally, okay, is taken up with small cap companies. Of course, people tend to gravitate towards small caps because there's a big return possible. But with a sell-off just happened, everyone now has gone for bigger caps because they realise, you know, there's a chance of doubling your money on some of these companies. So, okay, at five, National Express Group, up 6.8% today. NEX ticker there. Greggs, and I did tweet out recently saying, listen, if after the coronavirus, you know, people stop eating pasties and sausage rolls, then Greggs are in trouble. But you know what? I don't think they will. And yet it's dropped from like 24 quid to 13 quid of late. So that's Greggs down 3.45% today. At three, Royal Dutch Shell, down 1% to 9.07. At two, Eddie Stobart, that's ESL ticker, up 32% to 9.7 pence. And number one, most followed company, Cineworld, of course, had a big sell-off. Now it's bounced a little bit. But I don't know, they're still going to have problems the next few months with revenues, aren't they? All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Arc Minerals, sale of Casa Mining. At four, STX Energy, update on drilling operations in Morocco and Egypt. At three, Spinnaker Oports, whatever that is, subscription and update on medicinal cannabis. Spinnaker Opportunities, okay, I don't know what that is. And at two, Hurricane Energy, final results. And number one most liked RNS is from 88 Energy, and that's an operational update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.